My question is about opening public land. I mean, there's real hard access to getting information about what land's available for federal land, public access for camping on and other purposes for homeless use. And that's my question. Is when are they going to just open up the floodgates and let us know what land is okay? And let us start having it instead of other committees that are buying it all up so that no one can have it. And they use it for other purposes like building on and making money. And so that's what I'm talking about.
Does somebody want to address public land?
Okay.
I think the vastness of these United States actually was a solution to a lot of population problems, including homelessness and poverty, because whenever large populations suddenly became more houseless, the government would tend to give away land, like Oklahoma deal, there's California.
Even though it was Native American land.
Right. Even though it was Native American land, exactly. It was just that there was always room to expand, but I think what's different now is there's been, of course, ongoing privatization of every piece of property, that there's no other land to give away. Even like after the Emancipation Proclamation, you know, each slave was guaranteed, 40 acres and a mule,
they never got it.
But again, that was like, how do you solve the problem? You give away land, and then people could tend to their own needs that way, because on that land was the inherent theory of food and shelter, at least. But we're out of that now, and what we've seen definitely in the 20th century is the further privatization of property, including public property. And it used to be okay to camp in parks, public parks, on public land, federal land, but now it's just like these ordinances, the tone is that it's making that illegal, especially with urban parks. Last legislative session, or maybe 2 years ago, in Hawaii, there was a proposal law to open up all public lands to beachfronts, people could camp on the beaches until adequate shelter was provided for everyone else who didn't need to camp on the beach. I don't think it passed, but I think there's some sort of glimmer of hope that potentially things will shift around, that the public lands will become accessible again for people to camp on. And I think somebody had mentioned where the stadiums are now in Seattle, that was Hooterville, which was one of the most highly populated homeless camps. They had shanties, they had all kinds of things, they had the self-government model. And also, it was Seattle's where we got Skid Row, because they used to slide the logs down, so that term caught on around the country. And here in Olympia, it wasn't different. Like probably here down and further south a couple blocks was the shanty towns. People would build little shanties above the mud flats, you know, and that's where poor people would live. And so there was waterfront property. There was always a sort of accommodation of that sort of public space for to provide the needs for the desperate, the homeless, the help, for that shelter. And that doesn't exist anymore, but hopefully things will change. I'm hopeful.
Thank you, Pat.
Not really hopeful.
Pat, this is for you. Peter mentioned rent control. And it was my understanding that there's a state law that doesn't allow cities to have rent control. Can you please clarify that?
And hold your hand over the mic.
And what can we do to change that? Thank you.
I never want to give a simple answer to like, yes, Ruth, you're right. Again, the tension between the propertied and the less propertied have historical roots here in Washington, just like everywhere else. And it wasn't until 1973 that the landlord-tenant law was enacted to regulate some behavior between those who own the property and people that pay money to occupy it. Even though renters had existed here since, you know, before the white man even came here, I guess. And so, but that's sort of like making it a way to, or codifying that sort of exploitation of people and their need for shelter didn't exist before then, really. I've been working on this argument for one reason or another because I go to the legislature, but that law was originally passed, like I think like Tim alluded to, like in the 50s there was a lot of hotels, there was transitional housing basically, and that those apartments were furnished, and so when it comes, so people to move was just a matter of packing up the suit that they had in a suitcase and moving the next door down. But these days the law doesn't address the reality of today's tenants, which is, you know, you furnish an entire apartment, and moving is not just like packing up a suitcase. It's like you got to get a rent a truck and move. So another big shortcoming that Pete and Rob and I and other people talk about is the lack of affordable housing, and the way to regulate that, because right now it's just up to the marketplace. Landlords can charge whatever they want, and if they can find somebody to move in, then the system's working, right? So rent control was an idea that was suggested in Seattle in the late 70s, and they worked to pass an initiative to do rent control in the city of Seattle. It failed, and that freaked out the statewide landlord lobbyists so much that they went to the state legislative committee and got a law passed saying it's illegal to pass rent control anywhere in the state of Washington. And so in order for anyone to address affordable housing on a local level, they first have to go to the state level and repeal that law, and then they could pass something locally. So the difficulty is trying to get enough of the population to become active in legislative issues. A third of the state rents, it's, I forget how many millions of people that is. In urban areas like Olympia, it's close to 50% of the people actually rent. It would be great if Paul Allen would fund an initiative, because we would probably win, but the political system, the way it works, has not catered to the disenfranchised and the low-income like tenants, and so they're not in proportion, or they're not fully registered voters, and so they don't have a lot of sway oftentimes, especially in statewide elections. But if we could either somehow engage them to change the laws by lobbying, or put on pressure, more pressure on local or statewide and national officials to control rent that way, that would be the way to go, probably.
Roger.
I actually had a question, but if they actually give, like, free houses and furniture and that to Hurricane Katrina, why couldn't they actually do it to, like, other poor people? I mean, they got, a flood and it destroyed their houses, and they were poor then, and they're poor, and other people are poor, and how come they gave them
actually
free homes and furniture for them and not
the other people
that are poor?
Me and him is our spokesperson, our public spokesperson.
They didn't do a whole lot of people in Duluth.
Unfortunately, they talked about doing stuff for people in New Orleans, but a lot of people in New Orleans, the majority still don't have homes to live in or their furniture. So you have to go beyond the words, see what they actually did. And I think New Orleans, a lot of people still are homeless who had homes without furniture. So I think we need to build a movement that connects what's going on in New Orleans to here.
And also, I mean, I warn people that I talk, so if you don't want to hear a response, tell me. But also with that is the way that the federal government, FEMA, works in terms of how they decide to give that money, because actually in New Orleans, they gave FEMA funds to the landlords to rehab their buildings, and the landlords took that money, rehab their buildings, and then evicted everyone who was living there and were turning it into condos or things like that, so there's no restrictions. Locally here, after the earthquake, a number of downtown business property owners got FEMA money, and that was not passed on to the workers who were laid off because the building was decrepit and various things like that. And so there's also a connection to what, like how that funding is actually used, that it doesn't benefit poor people. It again, benefits the property owners oftentimes.
I want to thank all the panelists and the folks that are coming out to take this issue seriously. My name is Anna Schlecht, and I am with the City of Olympia. I work in the housing program, and I wanted just to say a couple things. I wanted to thank Rob for making very clear how the federal government has retreated from providing affordable housing and slashed budgets for people like me to try to create housing. I really appreciate what Pete had to say about we have to think big. I don't know, driving down here, I was trying to think, how big is the tenant union's budget? How big is Red and Rose's Advocacy Center's budget? Very, very small. We have to start thinking big and demanding bigger and a lot more decimal places, because one of the biggest solutions to poverty and homelessness is to get the real estate. And there are people in government that either know how or are learning how that would be needed. To figure out how to go after this money to create the real estate, which leads me to something I really appreciated about what Tim had to say, that emergency housing is not what people need. Permanent housing is what people need. Housing with dignity that's self-managed, and there are ways to create that. And I hope that people that are here listening who aren't already plugged into these kinds of organizations find a way to plug in, either with your time or your money, or if you have any kind of in-kind services that you can donate. The thing I wanted to pitch to folks as a question, or I guess as a request, I know I've talked with Selena about Camp Dignity in Portland, which hasn't been a complete success in some ways, but better than what people had. The city of Portland negotiated with people that are living on the streets, who created a camp, and I think that they've actually relocated them out near the airport, which is rather loud and not ideal. But is trying to, folks are trying to create a place where they can have, self-rule and integrity. I also understand that in Eugene and Salem, which is a fairly conservative capital city in Oregon, the cities there have seen their way clear to offering up city-owned parking lots that have bathrooms for car camping. So we have some Northwest examples, and I don't know if any of the panelists can speak to that, but finding ways to create some resources, because it's very cold out there. We're down the number of shelter openings that we have, and we need places for people to be in this community.
Oh, I got something to say on that. Back during the Depression, the federal government opened up a lot of campgrounds for poor people and stuff. And so even the federal government has precedents of doing that before. And that is a way to do something really cheap, shower facilities, cooking facilities, and a bunch of little pop-up tents. It's pretty cheap, and you could manage it. It could be self-managed. And historically, our country has done that before for people. And even getting back to the Katrina thing, putting them all in those dumpy little trailers. So I feel that's one short-term solution, or part of the solution to some of our problems, is to create some form of campground types of deal, because the permanent structures are the biggest thing. If we can get land from the city, it'd be real easy to set up a cookhouse, a shower house, and a bunch of little tents and RV trailers. But you got to remember, you can't stick us all the way out in Yelm or something.
Monica,
rest of the time too. So I just wanted to piggyback on what you were saying about solutions and thinking big, and I'd also like to start off by thanking the panel for putting this together and being here. My name's Barry, I'm with the Gleaners Coalition, if any of you know me, and I'd be happy to follow up with any of you. Dignity Village, actually, I'd like to clarify and expand on that a little bit. In Portland, started off by a movement from folks that were camping under a bridge in Portland, and they were rousted out from under that location. They loaded their stuff up into shopping carts, and they went marching around town until they compelled the city to find some kind of alternative. The city really wasn't forthcoming, but they found a strip of property near the airport, actually right next to a correctional facility that wasn't being used, and the city was not very supportive, really, of them being there. They wouldn't give them camping rights, but they set up house anyway, and their intention was to build their own community, much like the Hooverville that was spoken of, self-administering, self-governing, and they actually partnered with many different groups within Portland, City Rescue, and folks who did alternative construction techniques, cop housing and stuff. For $500 a unit, they built their own housing. They created a central place where services could come to. They have a library, they have internet connections, they have self-policing, they guard themselves, they take turns doing security 24 hours a day at the door, and they've been there for years. 3 years down the road, the city finally, 2 years ago now, I think it was, actually gave them permanent camp status. They had to build these structures 10 by 10 so that they weren't permanent housing because they had to be mobile because it wasn't a permanent campsite. All we need, I agree about thinking big, and there's structural issues here that have to be addressed, but in terms of finding immediate solutions, we have open property all over this county. We could enlist the help of folks from you could brainstorm your own collection of people that could do alternative construction techniques and build these structures. These are cob houses, so they don't need heat. They're self-insulating. They do have wood stoves and things. It's a brilliant facility. They share showers. It's a great structure. In terms of the structural thing, and just real briefly, I want to mention that we talk about poverty and poor, but what does that mean, really? And there's a structural and a historic thing. Back to the Victorian laws in England, basically, it was poor houses. If you weren't considered to be the deserving poor, a widow with kids who were left destitute by your husband dying off, because that was the model, right, very gender specific, then basically, and you were found laying about, you were beaten and then put into a poorhouse or a workhouse. I have photos of workhouses and poorhouses in the United States, one in Cincinnati built in 1909. That's the model here. We still operate based on that. That's the mentality that underpins it. The poverty level, $9,800 for one person this year. It's ludicrous. It's based on a food plan the USDA developed in the 40s that they knew was an emergency basis that nobody should live on, that they couldn't do it. When it was implemented as the poverty level in the 60s, they knew that only 10% of the people who actually tried to do this food plan would be able to come up with a nutritious diet because of the skills required in cooking and preservation and the time and stuff. It's the same food plan. They've adjusted it for the inflation rate, even though the cost of food grows quicker than inflation, and they know it. And it's still the same poverty level. It's half of what's required for self-sufficiency, and those studies are in place. So while we need to talk about that, I think the first thing is to do something about it. And I don't want to put anyone on the spot, but how many people in this room have sometime recently volunteered with an organization that is doing something either to help house or feed folks who are on the street? It's a pretty great community. I'd like to call on everybody to think about it and think about how much we need to talk about it with our friends, but we need to do something about it. How many folks here would be willing, if there was a 24-hour coffee shop that offered facilities for people to just come in, no money, whatever, to take a shift once a month? Maybe that's something we need to look for real estate for.
I just want to say something about the deserving poor quote, because they co-opted the poor a long time ago by saying, like, the senior citizen, the developmentally disabled, the mother with children, yes, they get the money and throw the bum out on the street, you know, like Habitat for Humanity, as a single person, I can't get a Habitat for Humanity home. You know, I got to be a welfare mother. Sorry to say the word, but that's basically it. Single people can't get housing through Habitat, HUD loans. A lot of it is turned off because it seems like some monies are funneled towards the so-called deserving poor, the youth, if under 25, you know, over 65, or women with children. And I think that's inherently unfair. I think we should take care of everybody in our society.
I was going to respond to, of course, but first, like to what Tim said, I think that's an example of like a lack of leadership, because what is happening is those budgets that administer those programs are getting cut, and so they try to come up with some sort of fucking logic that makes sense, that and they weed out certain people, and they always fall back on the idea that the marketplace will solve everything. Like a single man can get a job. A welfare mom cannot get a job, theoretically, because she's got to take care of her kid, you know? And so that's why single men...
I don't think that's the way the laws
are. But that's the logic of how they make these priorities of how it's administered, basically. But in Thurston County, PETA talked about, like, nationally, like, what constitutes poverty. In Thurston County, there are 75,000 people that are considered poor. 75,000 people. It's about 40% of our population in the Thurston County area. And those people live close to one paycheck away from being homelessness. Like they're just teetering on homelessness, basically. A lot of those people have some sort of income. In fact, those 75,000 people generate $500 million every year in this county. And if we could like somehow harness that money, we could solve a lot of problems. But those people, the money that they earn, they spend so quickly on like living expenses of food and shelter that there's not a lot of disposable income to use. So,
I'm not gonna have a problem.
Yeah.
My question is for Tim. Tim, when is the next Poor People's Union meeting, and how can people get involved?
Oh, you can come Saturday at 3 at the BRAC office, 1009 East 4th Avenue, and I want to have a potluck because, well, somebody has to make a whole bunch of flyers and somebody has to bring a whole bunch of food, because if you bring food, then everybody comes. Saturday at 3 p.m. at the BRAC office, which is 1009 East 4th Avenue. And actually, it's a union meeting. We're a dues-paying union organization, and I think we got the Constitution read already, whatever. And we got to vote on things like a mascot and other, well, there's a few different things we're voting on. It was all proposed at the last meeting. We're trying to get a skunk. I think a skunk's a good mascot. Huh? What?
A badger.
A badger? No, I like the skunk. Because we're the PPU, you know? PU.
Oh, yeah.
All right. I'm glad to see everybody out here tonight. A lot of you may have seen me around town, maybe not. If not, you may have heard me on the radio. My name is Josh. I am homeless. But I do a radio show called Hobo Radio every Thursday at 7 p.m. Tomorrow night I will be doing it, and I will be highlighting some of this stuff, hopefully.
What station?
106.5. That's called Radio. And I've been following this story for a couple months, and I'm not a native of Olympia. I'm actually from Arizona. And I have traveled all around the country, and I've seen these ordinances all over the place. Santa Cruz was mentioned, several other places. Tucson, Arizona, I helped try to fight this thing. They had a sit-in, which was similar to what happened in Tempe, Arizona, where they had a no-sitting ordinance, and people had a sit-in, and it went to the state Supreme Court. They had the right pro bono lawyers, I guess, but they got it thrown out. And I think it can happen here, too, if we really work hard. And we stick together, and like Tim said, bring the voice back to the poor. And also what he was saying earlier about, you know, hobos helping, and that's been pretty much the subject matter of my show, is how the poor has had a voice over the years, you know, especially with the big hobo movements and the Depression and the Dust Bowl. And they did help indeed start the IWW. And I think a movement like that can happen now, because there's even more homeless people in the country than ever before. And it's basically, you know, the whole racism thing has changed into classism, and I don't know, it's a real terrible thing. I don't know if anybody's ever seen any of the reports by the National Coalition for the Homeless, but if you go online and look it up, they have a 2006 report called Dream Denied, and it highlights some of the meanest cities across the country and some of the ordinances like this one that they have instated, and it has some of the nicest cities and the positive things that they did for the homeless, and maybe we can look at that and use those as an example as well. But anyway, if anybody had any ideas for my show, like maybe later after, or you know, come into the studio tomorrow at 6 p.m., I start my show at 7. I'm glad to have any guests on, especially the homeless, because I'm trying to be a voice for them, you know, being one of them. So thank you very much for coming out here and helping be a voice for all of us.
I was wondering if there are plans, folks, meeting to do follow-up to challenge the ordinance, whether it be to remain the insisting it be voted on or challenging it legally. It sounds like there's some hope that some precedent that similar ordinances have been unconstitutional. So is there a meeting time, place?
At the Poor People's Union meetings, we've been talking about the referendum process. Certainly be there at 3 on Saturday to talk about that. We're researching what the process is, how many votes we need, and I think we're going to go ahead and start moving forward and collecting signatures pretty soon. We have to figure out. There's a number of special elections coming up, and it would be on the city to decide basically when they want to spend money to get it put on the ballot. So it just, we would hope that they would wait till November so we would have time to organize. But basically at this point, we're just going to get ready to start collecting signatures. So yeah, you can definitely learn more at the meetings.
And I think it's an evolving process. And the signatures that are needed are City of Olympia registered voters. So if you're So like one thing you can all do right now is if you're not already, you can go register and vote so that when it comes time to sign the signature on the thing, the referendum, you'd be qualified. And also, to be a registered voter means that you can run for office, and next year there's 3 council positions open. And so we should try to figure out in the next year, or actually in the next 6 months, who in this room should be running for city council. Who should be running for mayor? Who should be trying to set the tone that we live in a safe city, we don't need these ordinances, and trying to change like policies in a positive way?
I say about politics, you run with the dogs, you get fleas.
Tim for mayor.
Is that your slogan?
Quick thing, you can talk about.
Go speak up.
Building unity. I think that's really important. And one thing you may want to consider is that it's always important to find things that help poor people and the rest of the working class at the same time.
Yeah.
Because a lot of times what they do, they split both ways.
That's right.
They'll either do things for they'll do things for the middle class that'll help the poor, or they've got a program that says, let's make this cheap. We'll just help the really poor people and we won't extend it to anyone else. And then the other working class people don't see themselves benefiting from it, and it's easy to cut out later on.
Mm-hmm.
And one other thing on building unity, just want to say, you know, you can be, you guys said some really kind of sexist things. I think you know that. I mean, on welfare moms, please try to avoid that. This isn't 1968. I hope we've grown way past that. Okay.
I just got thrown for a loop with that last part. But what was the first part was... Sorry. The division. I was going to just mention is that as part of the Dream the Dream process, the county, from my understanding, is they're having one of the Evergreen professors do a cost-benefit analysis about the cost of homelessness. And so I think that once that study is done, that there's a potential of using that information to say, this is how much it's costing our community in dollars and in lives and in health to our community, and to use that as a starting, one of the starting places and one of the tools to bridge the us and them, so that we can all see that it's costing our entire community, at, not only in resources and money, but also in health. I mean, if domestic and sexual violence are a, you know, huge contributor of homelessness, that tells us that there are thousands of people in our community that are experiencing violence in their homes and out on the streets. That's a huge cost to our community in many, many ways. And so I'm just throwing that out there that, you know, once that study's done, maybe that's one of the tools that we can use to try to bridge that divide.
And I'm excited by that study too, but right now we do have like information already that it costs $72 a day to keep somebody in our Thurston County jail. Yeah. It costs $35 a day to keep somebody in rental housing with supportive services. And so there's already a wide disparity on where we're deciding to put the money, you know, where the community's money is going to house these people, basically.
Hello?
Hello?
I guess more than any question, I think more as like a homeless guy on the streets since I was like 13, more as just like a general thing to put out there. Like, I think the whole world needs a little bit of empathy, like a lot of it. Like, stockpile that shit. Sorry. But every day I'll be on the street, and I'll meet one person. That one person, they'll look me in the eye and ask me what I really need. And I'm like, hey man, he actually stops and talks to me for a minute. What's going on, man? What do you need, you know? And I'd say like I meet one saint per like every 1,000 people. One saint that saves the day. And they're all awesome. Love them right here. Thanks, y'all. It means a lot. Especially someone like me.
Any other questions? Comments?
Oh, I think this talk is also kind of boisterous. So. I just look around this room, and there's a lot of people with a lot of different resources. I didn't see a sign-in sheet when I came in, so I'm wondering what happens when the 100 people blow out. And I think that there's a lot of people up there with a lot of great knowledge, and a lot of people in this room with a lot of great knowledge and ideas, all kind of here with, you know, like, preaching to the choir with the kind of same heart and same purpose in mind in our community. And I was just wondering, you know, what happens when we all shuffle out.
So should we talk about that for the remaining 15 minutes or so? Like, what's the next step?
Right. I know that in January, in January there's a hope that there will be a table, a very big table, and a lot of people will be sitting at the table.
Is Gary Brown?
And we'll be hopefully listening to each other and trying to really, really hear how we can find solutions and not just the hated word, Band-Aids. So that's in January. So we have this month to just keep educating people who you know, who don't know. And that's really more people than the 100 of us who are sitting here tonight. I think there's a lot of people out in our community who really don't have a clue as to what's going on right now in terms of poor people, in terms of houseless people, in terms of rights being violated, in terms of lack of affordable housing. And if we don't educate, nobody else is going to.
Like, I think one thing is, again, this is like an evolving process. When we first were scheduling this forum, it was
intended that it was going to be an educational event before the ordinance got passed, but they just did it so quickly, you know. And last week we actually had a lot of discussions about do we try to reformat it, but we didn't have any real good ideas. So it's an evolving process, and I definitely like the idea of a sign-in sheet, but definitely stay tuned in. Also, on January 15th, which is also Martin Luther King Day, we're doing this group I work with called Statewide Poverty Action Network is doing the second annual 74th commemorative hunger march on the state capitol. In 1933, Unemployed League of Seattle came down and did a hunger march demanding that evictions stop unless jobs are guaranteed. A lot of the things that we see here today actually that contribute to poverty, they were talking about at the Depression era, and they got some result with the legislature. And so it's going to be January 15th. We're going to gather probably in Sylvester Park or something and march on the state capitol and bring the idea and specific bills to legislators about what they need to pass to probably not solve poverty, but at least ameliorate it a little bit more than they currently are. So.
Since you said Sylvester Park, I just wanted to mention that all the downtown parks are in control of the state police. Right. So as a poor person, they don't let you hang out in the parks, because if you go in there with a backpack or if you lay a blanket down being a poor person, they tell you you're camping and you can't camp in here. They get aggressive and in your face. So that's another reason why this street ordinance is so bad, because we're already kicked out of the parks, and I think we should change that. The parks should be for everybody. And the thing is, they said, oh, too many drug addicts. Were like the sergeant and the chief of police said, yeah, we have it on camera, people shooting up in the gazebo. And I couldn't even believe that, you know. I couldn't believe that she said that, and I don't think anybody really did it. But they actually do not allow poor people in the parks, and they aggressively kick us out of the parks with these little unconstitutional, because there's no due process, trespassing orders. Basically, they say, oh, we didn't want you in the park anymore. It's the cop and the state police dude. And so they give you a 90-day or 1-year kick out of the park thing. But there's no due process involved to get it rescinded, so it's unconstitutional by our laws. And they still do it. But, you know, poor people are not allowed in the parks, and I don't like that.
Let's change that.
Right. And again, the spin that we want to, like, keep bringing up is, like, we're the second safest city in the nation. Like, even if somebody's shooting up in the gazebo, what, we're going to be the third safest? I mean, like,
one person,
you know, it's like, what is the logic that they propose by passing these ordinances or enforcing these administrative codes? It does nothing to improve our community at all. It just targets certain people.
Anybody here sleep outside last night?
Well, I was in my van.
I know that guest speaker, keynote speaker. Raise your hand if you slept outside last night.
We're very lucky we didn't have to. And I'm sorry you did.
And nobody should have to.
You don't know that I did.
I'm making that assumption, I'm sorry.
When you make an assumption, I appreciate it.
John, are we going to say something?
Did you want to speak?
I just wanted to say I'm an outsider, outside agitator. But if memory serves me correct, I just heard...
Misery or memory?
Memory and misery.
Okay, then. Speak.
Just heard the name of Martin Luther King mentioned, you know, on January 15th is coming up. Correct me if I'm wrong, but I think this might be the 40th anniversary of the Poor People's March on Washington, the Poor People's Campaign, which set up a Hooverville on the Capitol Mall. You know? You do have a Capitol Mall here, I assume that this is the state capitol. Indeed, you know, people ought to consider the fact that an action in Olympia is an action which attracts housing activists from all over the state and poor people from all over the state, you know? And that will certainly be an important cog in trying to push back any kind of fascist amendment here that puts people off the streets, you know? So I would just consider the fact that you do have a strategic advantage here. Think about history. Think about the history of social movements in this country. It was a tremendously successful campaign. And, you know, it brought people from all over the United States to the center of power. You've got the center of power in this state right here. Use it as well as you can in order to make this point. People need housing. 92 people died on the streets of Seattle last year. 92 people, man. This is, you know, a holocaust.
Are there any other comments? Any other questions? Yes, Jake.
I just want to say, because there was a few mentions of welfare, I feel like I have to make some corrections on behalf of women, because women and children are affected by homelessness more than men, and I totally agree with you 100% that everybody should have housing. It shouldn't be programs for the good poor people. However, you know, a welfare grant for a mother with two children is less than a grant for an individual on Social Security. And, a father, assuming that in most circumstances it's the mom who's got the kids and the father who doesn't, though that's not always the case, but in that situation, the mother on welfare is required to work 40 hours a week after her child is 3 months old. So the three-month-old baby's in childcare full-time while the mom's wasting time in the unemployment lines, and the father is only required to pay $25 a month in child support and isn't required to work. And, I used to coordinate the women's guest house at Bread and Roses, and there's fewer shelter beds in this town for women with children than there were for men, and that's wrong too. So I just want to say that on behalf of women, that it's not true that women are protected from the streets, or that children are protected from the streets, or that elderly people. I had a woman when I coordinated the guest house sleep on the couch at the guest house because there was no shelter for her. She was on hospice care, an elderly woman. She and her son needed $50 to get into a place. They had regular income to pay rent on the place. I called every church in this town, and it took forever to find somebody who was willing to help them out with that, because all the churches said they would only do grocery money. They wouldn't help anybody with rent. And so even the most vulnerable people who are dying, or people who are elderly, or people who are newborn babies, are vulnerable to homelessness. Thanks.
And women and children are the most likely to be poor in this country.
I think this has really been a good evening. And I think we just have to keep talking, and not talking to each other, talking to new people. There's a lot of new people that we don't talk to in Olympia, and they're the ones who have to learn. And that's our job between now and the end of this week. Okay?
Okay.
That's all. Thank you for coming.
Okay, wait, I do have one little specific action that people could do, taking off of what Selena just suggested. That in the work that I do, I've got like a million things to do, and one of the things that I need to do is set up educational presentations in our community about the correlations between sexual and domestic violence and homelessness. So if anybody out there wants to take it upon yourself to go talk to any community group about scheduling a presentation, they're free, they're a couple hours long, please do that. And let me know, or give them our contact information for Partners in Prevention.
I just want to make a quick announcement. I don't know if many of you know about this, but on the 21st of this December, there will be a homeless memorial for people who have died on the streets at the State Capitol steps at 4 p.m. on the 21st.
Thank you. Thank you all for coming.
Thank you very much. Before everyone leaves, just a few housekeeping things. Again, this event was put on by OMJP, so if you want to find more about us, you can visit www.omjp.org. And I have a quick announcement that this November 9th, there is going to be a vigil on 4th Avenue in the downtown Olympia for Peace on Earth, December 9th, November 9th, December 9th, hence, for a Peace on Earth to support the Lieutenant Mutada. and Susan Smith were both refusing to go back to the war in Iraq, and that all is also put on my own JP. And as everyone's getting up and leaving, if you could please help put your chairs away, like Mark is doing over there, and help us clean up, and that would really be great. Thanks. And if anyone else wants to help with dishes for Bruno Bombs, over there, they need some help.